You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Comedy is our subject tonight. We'll discuss the late Jerry Lewis with James Kaplan in a bit, but first we welcome Patty Farmer back to the show. We first met Patty Farmer when her excellent history of the nightclub known as the Persian Room was published a few years back, and we last spoke after the publication of the first book in what is going to be a trilogy of books on the Playboy empire, Playboy Swings. That book focused on the influence of Playboy magazine and the Playboy clubs on music of the era, and now Patty Farmer brings us Playboy Laughs, a history of comedy and Playboy. Patty Farmer, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me back, Gary. You know there's nothing I'd rather do than chat with you and chat about Playboy.
So before we get to talking about Playboy Laughs, what's going to be your third book in your Playboy trilogy?
The third one's going to be Playboy Thinks, about the editors and the writers and the interviewers, all the writing that went on at Playboy. And for all the men that used the excuse, you know, I read it for the articles. Once again, that was Hef's genius. He hired just the very best, the best writers and editors, etc.
How did you get, I'm not going to say obsessed, but slightly obsessed with Playboy in the first place?
You know, I never gave Playboy even a passing thought, quite frankly, until, you know, I started writing. And a lot of the people that I interview started telling me about it, started talking about it. You know, people like, Joan Rivers, you know, she'd off the hand mention, you know, well, starting out at the Playboy Club, you know, this or that. And a lot of other people I interviewed, you know, talked about working at the Playboy Club. So it kind of refocused my mind. And as you know, I'm an entertainment historian, and it just piqued my interest, so I started doing research and found out what a big contribution Playboy made to advancing entertainment in really all kinds of forms, from music to comedy to, of course, print. But a lot of people started there. You know, again, mentioning Joan Rivers, she started there as part of a trio, and people don't know that. So it really, the more research I did, you know, the more that onion had layers for me. And I was shocked that nobody else had written a book about it. There are books about, you know, everything else about Hugh Hefner's lifestyle, about the mansion, about the bunnies and the girls next door, but nothing about all these nightclubs and TV shows that had the great entertainers of our day on.
Did you have to sort of change your opinion of the magazine? Did you have an opinion of the magazine?
You know, I didn't really think poorly of the magazine. You know, I again, barely gave it a passing thought. And I did know enough about Playboy to know, you know, that, you know, their motto was "Nice Girls Did." And that was kind of the magazine they portrayed. You know, it was kind of an upscale men's magazine. It wasn't, you know, Hustler or Penthouse, or even back when they started in the 50s, there were, you know, tens and tens and tens of magazines similar to that, but they were all kind of graphic and down in the dirt, and Hefner elevated it. So I didn't think poorly of them, no. Not at all. I knew a lot of girls that had been waitresses, had been bunnies in the clubs, you know, a little bit older than me, because I unfortunately never got to go into the clubs. You know, I wasn't, you know, legal at that time, wasn't old enough. But, you know, this, you know, wealth of entertainment really surprised me. And in writing Playboy Laughs, I had the good fortune to have Bill Marks teach me a lot about comedy, and he wrote the foreword to the book. So, you know, even you know, going back, he left me with a thought. He said, gosh, if my dad and uncles, you know, the Marx brothers, were alive today, you can be sure that they would be playing at the Playboy clubs and also hanging out. So it's that kind of place.
Well, I love Bill Marx, and he was a guest here on the show, and he's the author of an autobiography called Son of Harpo Speaks, which is a fabulous book everybody should read. And I was just delighted that he wrote the foreword in your book and appears a couple of times in the book.
Now, he told me what it was like back when Dad and the uncles were performing, you know, vaudeville and burlesque, and, you know, all the people that he knew. You know, George Burns, you know, being in the house all the time and saying, there's no place to be bad anymore. And by that, George was lamenting the fact that there was no place to really start anymore, not be bad, like people think of at Playboy, but to learn your timing and learn what it was like to work in front of an audience. But it wasn't only the comics that were starting out. Eventually, a lot of the big names went back and played, you know, headlined there. I hate to, you know, keep going back to Joan Rivers, but I admire her greatly, and she was one of the pioneer female stand-up comedians. But she, as I said, started there as part of a trio, and then she appeared as a solo stand-up, and then she came back as a headliner. And she liked working the club. She said her misconception was that, and I don't even know how much I can say on your radio show.
Go ahead.
But she said she was shocked that the bunnies weren't sluts. She said the bunnies were great girls, and many of them became her longtime friends. So it was that kind of warm club atmosphere to play at.
Did you find any overlap in terms of the performers when you covered the Persian Room? Like Joey Lewis, did he ever play the Persian Room as well as the Playboy Club?
No, but Joey Lewis played a lot of the top clubs, you know, like the Copa, the Copa Cabana in New York, and many other top drawer clubs, which is kind of like the exact opposite coin. You know, the Plaza and the Playboy clubs are like two sides of the same coin. One, you went and you started out, and the other one was you had to be at the top of your game or ready to appear there, and that was, you know, the Persian Room.
Speaking of Joey Lewis, I think there are a lot of performers that you and I know because we have studied that maybe people today have never heard of or have forgotten. So tell me some of the comedians that you discovered when you were writing your book. You interviewed a lot, and you wrote little biographies of them. Who'd you never heard of or were unfamiliar with?
Yeah, and again, I just was not that familiar in the field of comedy, but people like Jackie Curtis, you know, he did such an abundance of work, and he worked in Vegas, and he headlined, and he opened for a lot of comedians. I did not know about Jackie Curtis. And, gosh, he was another one that just helped me out a lot explaining the comedy field and what it was like. He started in the circus, you know, as a six-year-old little kid. And that was, you know, almost the circus almost came before, or probably at the same time as vaudeville and burlesque. But people like Jackie and Howard Storm. You know, many people know Howard as the producer of a lot of great TV shows, Mork and Mindy, and I can't even think of all the shows he produced, but he was part of a comedy team at Playboy. And, you know, all these guys, Lou Alexander, you know, maybe not household names, but certainly, you know, lifelong artists who worked in their field. And then, of course, you have the Tom Dreesens and the Rodney Dangerfields and Jackie Gales and Rich Little. You know, I had the fortune to sit down with Rich, and Shecky Green gave me a lot of insight. And the women, you know, Lily Tomlin, Kay Ballard. I did not get to talk to Phyllis Diller, But I did a lot of research on her and included that in the book, and a couple of the other gals that had passed before I had the opportunity to talk to them, Toadie Fields, and just a wealth of comedians. And again, you had people that were starting out, and many were discovered there. Many of our, irreverent comedians, you had your Lenny Bruce and your George Carlin and your Steve Martins, so just the Playboy Clubs were around for decades, and the evolution of the different groups, you had the David Letterman and Jay Leno and David Brenner and that group, and then you had the older ones, like I mentioned, the Sheckies and Jackie Gales and that group. And it was just very, very interesting to me, and a lot of people were discovered. Flip Wilson was discovered there, and Red Fox performed there, and Jimmy Walker, just all these great comedians.
I was also like so thrilled that you not only talked about the comedians and the clubs, but you talked quite a bit about the wonderful cartoonists in the pages of Playboy.
Right. That was a total new field for me, because growing up, as a girl, I wasn't really that much into cartoons, and I was not old enough to remember when Mad Magazine started, and I'm sure maybe my brother had gotten comic books, but all the great books, Plastic Man and all those were out before I was around. So I got to learn and meet a lot of the guys who did those. One of Hef's genius moves in all of the Playboy Empire was hiring the very best he could find, and he hired cartoonists like Jack Cole and Leroy Neiman and Shel Silverstein and Jules Pfeiffer, Arnie Roth, and Mort Gerberg. All these great cartoonists worked for Playboy and on a regular basis, and they tell a lot of funny stories, but a lot of inside what it was like working that way. And I don't know if you know, but Hugh Hefner is a micromanager. And this is back in the late 50s, 60s, 70s. The internet wasn't really, part of how we did business. So you had people like Vargas, with his iconic Vargas girls, and he'd Playboy would tell him what they wanted, and he'd draw up what he thought they wanted following their directions, and send it. He'd put it in an envelope and send it from LA to Chicago, and Hugh Hefner would look at it and edit it, and draw put his little edits right on the proof. And then again, he'd put it back in an envelope and send it out to L.A., and it would go on like this until, Hef thought it was perfect. And it went on this way every single month. So it was really these great artists, but it was exactly the image that Hugh Hefner wanted in his magazine.
Well, I loved your interview with Jules Pfeiffer, who said that he didn't want to change his style to fit New Yorker magazine or other magazines. He was published in Village Voice, which didn't pay him anything. And then Playboy came along, and that Hugh Hefner allowed him to express himself the way he wanted, and that Hugh Hefner's edits that he mailed to him by a thing called a letter in the mail were really right on, that his edits were really great.
Exactly. And again, I didn't know that Jules wrote Carnal Knowledge, and we had spent hours talking, and just kind of as a toss away when we were wrapping it up, Jules told me, he said, I got all my best ideas for writing Carnal Knowledge from hanging out at the mansion in Chicago. And you know, it clicked for me. That's right. You know, Carnal Knowledge didn't start out as a movie. It was a book written by Jules Pfeiffer.
Yeah. So. Yeah, a great script, directed by Mike Nicholson. Great movie. I was just so pleased. And also the story of Harvey Kurtzman. You mentioned Mad Magazine, and Harvey Kurtzman was the founding editor of Mad. And then he went on to create Little Annie Fanny and Playboy, which was, you know, didn't you say there were over 100 episodes of Little Annie Fanny?
It was a big project. You know, each one of the Annie Fannies was almost like a painting, you know, a piece of art in itself. And this had to be turned over very rapidly for a monthly magazine. So Hess brought in help to help get this done. And Arnie Roth and Al Jaffe were two of the guys that helped him. I think Will Eisner might have also been there. But Hess put them up in a hotel in New York, one of the best hotels, and said, just stay there until you get it finished, you know, work around the clock. And they worked on it almost like an assembly line, and they still weren't getting it done. You know, Will Eisner kept washing it out because it wasn't perfect as far as, you know, his opinion. So Hef had said, look, you guys, you know, you're spending way too much money in this hotel, and it's not getting done, and my deadline for the magazine's coming up. I'm sending a plane, and you're going to finish it at the mansion. So, you know, this is probably endemic of Playboy in itself. They made far too much money and spent far too much money. But to fly the guys first class from New York to Chicago cost, I think, quite a bit more than keeping them in the hotel a few more days. And then they worked in the mansion in Chicago and had to share bathrooms with the bunnies, who were kind of on the other side of the hallway. And a couple of the guys weren't too happy about that. But they finally got the job done. And in Playboy Laughs, I go into a lot more detail.
Fascinating, fascinating stuff. And you got to talk to a lot of these great people, cartoonists, comedians, and all these great interviews that you did. That must have been a lot of fun for you.
Oh, it was tremendous fun. And, you know, with all the people that I interview, they're so interesting that any chance I get to keep up the conversation, I do. You know, long after the interviews were done, I would still call Al Jaffe when I was in town, and if he was free, he'd invite me over. And he'd just sit and talk about Mad Magazine and the games and how he started the Fold-In, you know, which, for any of your listeners that don't know, it was a big deal at Mad Magazine. The back cover was a thing that you ripped off and you folded, and it was a message. But not only did he start it, he is still doing it. At 96, I went to see him about a month ago, and he was working on one for the latest issue of Mad. So I think these guys, you know, they just, they're funny right to the end. They can't stop.
Tell about that cake that they gave him.
Oh, that was over at...
it was the Daily Show.
Daily Show, that was it. And they invited Al to come, and they had a birthday cake for him. And it was just like a fold-in where you cut a piece of cake out, and you push it together, and it had a different message. It said, gee, you're really old now, you know, as the punchline. You know, I love the line that Hess threw out, and I don't know if you know, you probably do, you know everything, Gary, but Hess also, and Playboy, they wanted to start their own comic magazine. And they called it Trump, and with a totally different meaning than it meant today. And he hired Harvey Kurtzman to put a gang of the best together, and it was quite a big deal over at Mad Magazine, because he took everybody. He took all the Mad guys with him, and they were not happy with him for doing that, but they they only came up with two issues before Hef pulled the plug. And I love the line. He, when asked, you know, what went wrong, and he said, "I gave Harvey an unlimited budget, and he surpassed it."
I do have a couple issues of Humbug, which was the magazine that came after that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So do I. I got hooked. I didn't get to watch them or read them when I was a kid, but I have a closet full of comics now.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you're a convert to our comic book. Well, you know, Patty Farmer, you really give Playboy magazine a lot of credit for a lot of aspects of our popular culture, music and comedy and thought, as we're about to find in your next book. How did it happen? What, tell us a little bit about Hugh Hefner and this brainchild of Playboy.
Well, Hugh Hefner actually wanted to be a cartoonist, and that's what he aimed all his goals for. He was cartooning since he was a little kid, and that's how he journaled. You know, he'd journal himself, draw himself, doing all these different things, meeting girls or taking a test in high school. And he really thought he would make his living as a cartoonist. And he submitted his work around Chicago to no success. And in 1951, he came out with a comic book, a full 74-page comic book with a huge name. It's called This Toddlin' Town, a rowdy burlesque of Chicago's manners and mores. And it was good. You know, I've read it. I actually do have a copy. But he just wasn't good enough. And, you know, there were a lot of better cartoonists. So that's when he turned his attention to putting out the best men's magazine he could. But how the world would have been different if somebody said, "You're doing a great job. Why don't you come draw cartoons for me?" But they didn't, and he started Playboy. He started an empire instead.
And it's had not only an amazing effect on our culture, but it's led us to Patty Farmer's trilogy of books, of which the second has just been published. It's called Playboy Laughs, The Comedy, Comedians, and Cartoons of Playboy. Patty Farmer, thanks so much for chatting with us today on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Gary. I really enjoyed it.
Patty Farmer is the author of Playboy Swings and the brand new Playboy Laughs, The Comedy, Comedians, and Cartoons of Playboy. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. In 2005, the late comedian, actor, philanthropist, and filmmaker Jerry Lewis published the memoir Dean and Me, A Love Story. He chose as his collaborator journalist, historian, and novelist James Kaplan. James Kaplan went on to write the two-volume definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. I spoke with James Kaplan when Dean and Me was published, and I asked him how he came to collaborate with Jerry Lewis.
I profiled Jerry Lewis for the New Yorker magazine in 1999. The piece appeared in 2000, and that was the first time we met. When we met, Jerry immediately handed me a, I think it was a seven-page sheet with about 100 talking points for our interview. That was Jerry. I didn't quite know yet that that was Jerry, but that's Jerry. He is all about quantity. He's about control. He's about... He is about getting everything right, and number one on that list, out of 100 subjects, including the mob and Frank Sinatra and everything else you can imagine, was Dean Martin, with 5 exclamation points. So we talked a lot about Dean Martin during the course of our the next few days in his home office in Las Vegas. We talked about a lot of other things, too, but... He let me know toward the end of the interview that he had been writing down reminiscences about Dean since the day that Dean Martin had died, which was Christmas Day of 1995. I told him that I would love to see some of them sometime. And so after the interview was over and after the profile ran, and he was very fond of the profile, he was happy with the profile. Despite the fact that it was, I can say that it was anything but a puff piece. It was, certainly wasn't a hatchet job, but it was a very clear-eyed look at Jerry Lewis at that point in 1999. Every once in a while after that, he would send me some of what he had been writing, and I was always fascinated by what he sent me. He soon let me know that he had accumulated something like 1,000 pages, and always in the back of my mind, I thought, well, you know, Jerry, I could help you with that, but I didn't feel that I should jump in and offer my services. I didn't want to be pushy about that. I didn't know how he felt about what he was doing, and I thought he might want to have it to himself. But last May, May of 2004, and we had been in and out of touch over the years. A little bit out of touch when he was sick, but then he got better. And I was sitting around my office one spring afternoon, the phone, Friday afternoon, as a matter of fact, usually a dead day for me. The phone rang about 2 p.m., and there was that unmistakable voice on the other end of the line. And he said, "Hi, Jim, it's Jerry Lewis." I said, "Hi, Jerry." He said, "Jim, would you help me with my book?" And I said, "Jerry, I'd be honored to help you with your book." And that's how it started.
Now, Jerry has written other books before.
Yeah.
And did he write them himself, or did he have co-authors?
No, he did an autobiography in 1982 with another writer, and he... I think it's fair to say that Jerry was quite... was not happy with the book.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I'm not even sure he ever read the book. but it wasn't a successful book on any basis, really.
Yeah.
I did read a lot of it. And he has he's written a couple of other books, but this was I sensed immediately that this would be a very successful way, a cogent way, a non-egocentric way, if you will, to write his autobiography. And I don't mean to say that by writing the book about his partnership with Dean Martin that he was writing his own biography, his own autobiography. Just that by writing about Dean, and by trying to express a lot of his very complicated feelings for Dean Martin, all of which I don't think are entirely resolved yet, even after all these years, I think that he was doing autobiography in a way that got away from just Jerry Lewis and eliminated many of the excesses that perhaps some of his critics have laid at his doorstep.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in a minute. And let me say that it's a marvelous book, and I really enjoyed reading
Thank
it.
Thank you so much.
But how much of the book is Jerry Lewis? How much is you? And in general, when you go about crafting someone's autobiography, as you did John McEnroe's, how do you get the style of a non-writer telling us a story?
Well, there are several important differences between McEnroe and Jerry, one of which is that in a lot of ways Jerry is a writer. He is an amazing storyteller. He has written dozens of screenplays. He's not a prose writer, and he's a screenwriter but not a prose writer, although he has a kind of inimitable prose style. It's not exactly the style you see in the book. And so my job with both of these books, actually, just to step back for a minute and look at the strange animal of the co-authored book, co-authored celebrity autobiography. My job is to capture the voice, to sound more like the person than the person could sound himself if he were writing it down himself. And it's tricky. It's tricky. I don't want to inflate myself here, but it is a tricky task, because if it's too much one person or the other. It just it doesn't work. And what I like to think is that my background as a fiction writer has helped me a lot in this process, because I flatter myself by thinking that I have a good ear for voices. And what you have to get right away when you're doing these books is the voice.
Well, I think you accomplished that. But how do you keep Jerry Lewis's, you know, tendencies from sort of overwhelming the book, if you know what I mean?
Well, it's about 3 days after that phone call I told you about, that May 2004 phone call, a crate arrived on my doorstep. And I'm not exaggerating. It was not a box. It was a crate. It looked like it was about the size of a dormitory refrigerator. And I opened it up, and it contained two gigantic red is Jerry's favorite color, leaf notebooks, each holding about 1,000 pages of stories, of reminiscences. And I immediately saw that in a certain way I had a gold mine, and in another way I had a big job in front of me. And what I set about doing was very carefully reading all 2,000 pages and cataloging them. And I cataloged them by theme, by date, and I also cataloged them, these stories, by usability. And a lot of the stuff there, and I'm getting around to answering your question, there was a certain amount of material that felt as though it was more about Jerry Lewis than about Dean Martin, and so I had to sort of put that aside. There was a certain amount of repetition. There was, since Jerry is nothing but nothing if not a man who revels in excess, there was a certain amount of excess, both in terms of rhetoric and storytelling, and Jerry loves that, but I felt that for the book, for the purposes of the book, it was important to tone it down. And so the trick was to keep it kind of, it really was a trick. The trick was to keep it kind of pretty light, yet pretty serious, and pretty funny, but not too jokey, and all in all, always sounding as though Jerry's voice was in my ear.
Well, and I think you've definitely accomplished it, and it's as I say, it's a lovely book. One of the things that you did in the book, and I don't know if you did it or Jerry did it, is the way the book is structured. Toward the very end of the story, there's like a flashback to the very beginning.
Yes.
And that's a marvelous little technique that you used. Was that you or Jerry, or how did that come about?
The structure of the book was mine, but the inspiration for the structure of the book was Jerry's. The 2,000 pages he sent me were completely out of chronological order, and he had a strong feeling from the beginning that he wanted a book that was out of chronological order. He didn't want a conventional book. He didn't want a book that just went. He told me right at the jump, he said, I don't want a book that says, I was born in Irvington, New Jersey. You know, he just didn't want the kind of standard, and then I wrote autobiography at all. He wanted it completely out of chronological order, but I knew my grounding as a storyteller, my teaching taught me that you have to have, a great teacher of mine, an editor at The New Yorker, as a matter of fact, fiction editor, once typed up on a little piece of paper for me, leg over leg and the dog got to Dover, meaning tell the story, tell it in order. So my job was to try and figure out a way we could have a spine for this story. We could have a chronological order, but we could jump around in time a little bit. And I felt that as the story drew toward its end, that there was a great amount of sadness accumulating. And, you know, Dean Martin was in increasingly poor health. He lost his his greatly beloved eldest son to a terrible. His son was in the Air National Guard in California, and he crashed his Dean Martin's son crashed his jet into the side of a mountain in 1987. So his Dean Martin's already somewhat precarious health declined steeply after that. And Jerry had a lot of physical problems too. The end of the story, as we drew closer to the present day, got pretty sad. And I was just feeling the need at the end of the book for a flashback, for a look again at when these guys were at just this incredible moment in Atlantic City in July of 1946, when they first became Martin and Lewis, and they were so young and so strong and so great looking and vital and so funny.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Tonight we're listening back to a conversation I had in 2005 with James Kaplan, who collaborated with Jerry Lewis on Jerry's memoir, Dean and Me, A Love Story.
It seems apparently impossible to really convey to people today what Martin and Lewis were actually like. I mean, their films are stiff and, frankly, not that good. And on the Colgate Comedy Hour, they're reined in by television.
Yeah, I would disagree slightly about the Colgate Comedy Hours. I would agree mostly about the film. Films had many problems. The Colgate Comedy Hours, I would argue, have... I think you get a real... In many places in the Colgate Comedy Hours, you get a lot of real... you get a real breath of the inspiration that flowed between these two guys, because even though there was plenty of writing, but these were guys who reveled in tearing up the script and in ad-libbing, and you see a lot of that in Colgate. It was, don't forget, it was live TV. It was not taped. So it was a real tightrope act, and I think there's a lot of great stuff there. But yes, when you take a couple of steps back, fundamentally you're right. The essence of their insanity and of their incredible charm was in the nightclub performances. There are witnesses. There are people like Orson Welles. Orson Welles said that when you saw Martin and Lewis in the nightclub, he said he had never seen anything as funny in his life, and a number of people said that. Alan King said that too. But Orson Welles said people peed their pants. That was his expression. People peed their pants. And it was true. Just the sheer anarchy of that act, which you see a bit of on Colgate. But, you know, in the restaurants and the nightclubs, Jerry was running, he was bouncing off the walls, he was smashing plates, he was spritzing people with seltzer bottles, cutting people's neckties, and Dean Martin, who was constantly undervalued and undercut by critics and neglected totally, was, in fact, the genius straight man of all time, had an absolute brilliance about bringing Jerry back to earth. He just knew how to reel Jerry back in and bring the act to ground and give it some solidity. And they were magic.
Jerry argues in the book that Martin and Lewis are funnier than Bing Crosby and Bob Hope or Abbott and Costello or whatever because of the emotion that they had for each other.
He also argues that they were funnier than those guys because they worked without a script. Mostly they worked without a script. I think a certain amount of that is chauvinism. You know, it's just Jerry. It is the necessary vanity of the great performer. You know, there's no great performer who doesn't have that kind of vanity. You can't be a great athlete, for that matter, or a great performer without feeling that you are God's gift to the world, that you're the best of all time. Jerry certainly has that feeling in abundance, and to a great degree, he's right. To a great degree, Martin and Lewis were the funniest team ever. Jerry argues that Hope and Crosby didn't like each other that much. I think there's a certain amount of basis to that. But, you know, I got to tell you, it may sound seditious, I love a good road picture every once in a while, and I think that the Hope and Crosby movies, by and large, are more successful than a lot of the Martin and Lewis movies.
Well, they were wholly created as cinema rather than trying to transfer something to the movies, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But going back to what you originally said, I think there is something very important there, and that is that for the first, Jerry likes to say the first 8.5 years of their 10 years together, I think in fact it was probably closer to maybe 6 or 7 years of the 10 years, there was a huge amount of affection. And when you look at the early, between these two guys, when you look at the early Colgate comedy hours, you can see in Dean's eyes, and Dean was not an easy laugh, he wasn't an easy sell by any means, you can see that he was knocked out by Jerry, that he thought Jerry was funny, and he thought Jerry was charming, and Jerry was. He was a force of nature, and I think Dean was just kind of bowled over by him. I think there was a huge amount of affection, and I think, unfortunately, they both found ways to undercut that affection and finally destroy it. For a number of years after they broke up, he wasn't, in a lot of ways, he wasn't a terribly attractive person. His ego really did run amok in the late 50s into the mid 60s.
And he does talk about that in the book, very frankly.
Yeah. But then life really began to kick him in the rear end in the mid 60s onward, and he had a lot of reverses, and both financial and health reverses, and he was really brought down in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Martin and Lewis are so legendary, but both of them did better work alone. That is, I'm sure their nightclubs act, as you were discussing earlier, were fantastic, and if we could have seen them, we would have peed our pants. But since we didn't, I don't know how.
Well, I would say better recorded work separately.
Right. And Jerry Lewis's films, the first maybe the first 7 or 8 of his films, are better than any of the Martin and Lewis films.
Oh, by far. And The Nutty Professor is a masterpiece.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're great films. And of course, Dean went on and did. His films are okay, although some of them were excellent as a dramatic actor. And he did, his television show was a fantastic show.
Yeah, his television show was fantastic. It's funny because he had an early start in 1957-58 as a serious dramatic actor, and to everybody's astonishment, an extremely competent and well-regarded dramatic actor in The Young Lions and Some Came Running. And he had every indication of becoming, he was acting alongside of Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and holding his own completely. Mm-hmm. He had every indication of becoming a real serious force. And for whatever reason, he decided to go light. He suddenly, not so suddenly, he went from acting alongside Clift and Brando to doing the Matt Helm pictures.
Right.
He loved Westerns. He was unapologetic about that. And he did Rio Bravo, of course, and did a wonderful job in Rio Bravo. Then he did a lot of send-up Westerns, with Sammy Davis Jr. And so I think that he never liked to get too serious. He always liked to have his fun, and I don't think he really gave a damn what anybody thought. They had a terrible feud. They didn't speak for 20 years, and they said awful things about each other in the press. But there was a point about a year after they broke up, they hated each other, and America hated them for breaking up. And Dean, he spent a terrible year after they broke up commercially. He couldn't get arrested. He was working fifth-rate nightclubs. And he was in a nightclub in Pittsburgh doing his act. And somebody yelled out something nasty about Jerry, and Dean defended him. They did that. They did that. And when you see that astonishing piece of videotape of the reunion on the 76 telethon, I get goosebumps because it was real, because there was something between these two guys that, as nasty as it got, and it got plenty nasty, there was really something there between them.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guests, Patty Farmer. Her new book is called Playboy Laughs, The Comedy, Comedians, and Cartoons of Playboy. And James Kaplan, the author of many books, including Dean and Me, A Love Story, which he co-wrote with Jerry Lewis. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.